You're listening to The Critical Thought, where we challenge our listeners to use critical thinking when examining the teachings of Jehovah's Witnesses.
Hi, this is Lady C.
And this is JT. And welcome to another episode of The Critical Thought. In this episode, we have a guest visitor on our site. His name is John DeLynn. And what John will let all of us know is that as Jehovah's Witnesses, we are not alone. You see, John DeLynn is an American psychologist, podcast host, and he is also an excommunicated member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, what we often refer to as the Mormons. Now, John has a very interesting background. John, he went to college at Brigham Young, and he went on to get his master's degree, and now he also has his PhD in clinical psychology. And so we're going to have him share with us what it was like growing up and living the life of a Mormon. But more importantly, we want people to see that Jehovah's Witnesses are not the only high control group out there. We're going to see just how dangerous power in the wrong hands, especially absolute power of controlling people's lives and dictating people's lives, can impact them. So we'd like to welcome John to our site. John, thanks for giving us the opportunity to do this interview.
Oh, JT and Lady C, I just adore you guys. It was so nice to have you on Mormon Stories podcast. And I love the work you do. I believe in the work you do. So this is a real sincere honor for me. So thanks for having me.
You are so welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, absolutely. We have so much in common, and I think it's absolutely critical that people get this opportunity to see, so they can see what these commonalities are. And so it helps all of us to be able to use, as we always tell people, use your critical thinking skills. So as I said before, John, we thank you for taking the time. We know we're in different time zones, but we finally was able to work out the time, and we're glad to have you here.
My pleasure. Thanks again.
Yes. Now, what we like to do is, just to get started, just to lay the groundwork, we have some questions that we wanted to ask you to help our audience to better understand the Mormons or the Latter-day Saints and how they operate, how they touch people's lives, and more importantly, how you were able to get out, and as we say, get out with your sanity. So could you start off by just letting us know something about your background, family, and how you became part of the Mormon religion?
Sure. Yeah, so I am a sixth generation Mormon. Like many Mormons, my ancestors go back to the very founding of the church. My ancestors knew the Joseph Smith, the founder of Mormonism. They knew Brigham Young. They joined the church. Most of them joined the church either in England or, you know, out west where the Mormons got their start. You know, most of my ancestors crossed the plains as Mormon pioneers in the mid-1800s and settled either, you know, parts of Utah or Idaho. So that's my upbringing. I have the, like many Mormons, I have the dubious, odd distinction of coming from polygamous ancestors. And for me, it's actually really kind of close, kind of close in my generational line. So my mother's mother, my grandmother, was the daughter of a polygamous family. So Karma Parkinson Benson, which is my maternal grandmother, she was the daughter of either a second or a third wife in a Mormon polygamous marriage. And I knew my grandmother before she passed away. So I was able to talk to my grandmother about what it was like to grow up in a polygamous household, where my great-grandfather would travel throughout the week from wife to wife to household to household, make his visits and kind of make the rounds, you know, and they lived a polygamous Mormon life. So my mother grew up in a traditional rural Mormon home in Franklin, Idaho, which is in the same town as Preston, Idaho. They're neighboring towns. That's where Napoleon Dynamite was filmed. So Napoleon Dynamite is a very Mormon movie And that's the area where my mom comes from. My dad was born and raised in Salt Lake City. And so I became Mormon, like most Mormons, because my parents and grandparents were Mormon. I'm a little bit different than many Mormons in that my parents, once they got married, had some kids, they moved to Texas. And so I spent 5 years, I was born in Boise, Idaho, but the first five of the first years of my life were in Dallas, Texas. And then the bulk of my upbringing was actually in Katy, Texas, which is a suburb of Houston. So my early formative Mormon years were in Texas, believe it or not. And I have the distinction of going to Katy High School and going to high school with Renee Zellweger, who is a famous Academy Award-winning actress. She was a friend of mine. I loved her so much, I tried to make her a Mormon when we were in high school together. I've got a funny story about that. But yeah, so I did all the things. I served a Mormon mission in Guatemala, a 2-year Mormon mission in Guatemala. A couple months of that were in Arizona. But I went to Brigham Young University, as you said. I got married in a Mormon temple in Washington, D.C., and did the whole Mormon upbringing up until my early 30s. And that's when things started to go sideways a bit. But I was Mormon for 45 years before things really went sideways. And I don't want to steal your thunder, so I'll wait for more questions before.
I have a question being female. Yeah. Because John said that he talked to his grandmother and she was in a polygamous marriage. I want to know if she talked about whether she liked that or not.
So she wasn't, just to be clear, I may have misspoke. She wasn't married to a man who had multiple wives. Her mom, my grandma's mom, was one of multiple wives.
Yeah.
She said, hey, it was fine. She basically said, I got along well with my mom. I had lots of siblings. I loved my dad. He was a prominent, wealthy doctor in the kind of Idaho, Utah area. And she also had, you know, the sister wives are the other moms. So basically in a polygamous marriage, if you're a kid in a polygamous family, it just means you have a lot of moms. And as far as I know, they all didn't live in the same household. So it wasn't like she knew about the sister wives. She knew about her other moms, but I don't think they were like intimately involved in her life. That wasn't the type of family that this family was. It was more like she had her mom. Her dad visited regularly and she was close to her dad, but her dad also visited the other families. She knew about the other moms. She loved them. She knew about her other siblings through the other moms, but wasn't like living with them. And, you know, she basically said she had a good time growing up. Now, how the wives felt is probably a different story. And you'll often get anything from we all got along great to there was a lot of jealousy and animosity. Two, I didn't like it, but I put up with it. Two, we got divorced and, you know, everything fell apart and I felt mistreated and abused. Several of Brigham Young's wives divorced him, and some of them even wrote memoirs about how awful it was being a wife of Brigham Young. So you'll get all sorts of different variations on what it was like to grow up under polygamy. And there's a book called In Sacred Loneliness. If you ever want to learn about Joseph Smith's polygamy, the founder of Mormonism, and then what it was like for the wives of our founder, because he had over 30 wives. Joseph Smith, the founder of Mormonism, okay, had over 30 wives. And wow. If you want to know, that'd be like Taves Russell. Is that the founder of
Charles Taves Russell.
Charles Taves Russell. It would be like your founder having 30 wives. Well, that's what Mormonism has to deal with. Our founder had between 30. Joseph Smith had so many wives. We don't know for sure how many wives he had. That's something that we have to deal with within Mormonism. But if you want a really good book on the wives of Joseph Smith, you can read a book called In Sacred Loneliness, which talks all about that.
Wow. Now,
also, I should just mention Joseph Smith married 14-year-olds. He married mother-daughter pairs. He married sister pairs. He married other men's wives. So, you know, women that were married to other men, he would like send a man on a mission to Europe and then marry his wife while the husband was out of town. That's how Mormons rolled in the early days.
Oh my God.
Now, 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 let me ask you this, because this is very important. Now, you mentioned that the Mormons moved out to Utah. What was the reason they ended up having to move out to Utah?
So that's funny, because I remember talking to you guys about how sometimes the witnesses don't hear the same, don't hear the truthful history, or don't always hear the church would give a spin on the history that isn't necessarily accurate, but that paints the church in the best light. I grew up thinking that Mormons, so the Mormon church starts in upstate New York in a town called Palmyra, in the 1820s, and the church was formally started. The Book of Mormon was kind of worked on in 1827 by Joseph Smith. The Book of Mormon comes out in 1829 in Palmyra, and then in 1830, the Mormon church is officially organized with actually a different name than it has today. The reason why, early on, Joseph Smith, before he started the Mormon church, it was engaged in a practice called treasure digging, where there are all these rumors and folklore that buried treasure could be found along the New England coast, because there had been Spanish conquistadors and pirates and lore about buried treasure. And really superstitious people back then believed that you could use special objects like a peepstone to look underground and see the buried treasure. And this was called scrying or glass looking. Joseph Smith, as a boy, learned about peeping or scrying or glass looking. And because he was in a family that was super poor, they were failed farmers, he realized, hey, I know a way to make money. I'm going to get a peepstone and convince my neighbors that I have the ability to see buried treasure underground. And so from 1820s, early 1820s to 1827, Joseph Smith would lead his neighbors on treasure digging explorations, where he would take a stone, put it in a hat, put his face in the hat, and he could convince his neighbors to go on these treasure digs, where he'd lead them to a site. He would say, hey, oh, there's buried treasure down here. They would all start digging, and then Joseph would go, oops, oh, you didn't kill the chicken in just the right way, or you didn't say the right words in the right order. The spirit that was guarding the treasure removed the treasure. And so this was how Joseph Smith got his start, convincing people that he had special powers to find buried treasure. So when the Book of Mormon comes out and he claims that there's golden plates that were hidden in a hill, that an angel was guarding, all his friends that were like, hey, wait a minute, you're supposed to, we were treasure diggers together. This is gold. We want to get the money too. We want the money. It caused this big uproar that caused, you know, basically, because Joseph Smith was known as a charlatan. He was known as a folk magic treasure digger. So the first time the Mormons relocate is right after the church is formed, and everybody wants these golden plates that Joseph Smith said existed. They all wanted the money and the gold. And so Joseph Smith relocates to Kirtland, Ohio. That was right after the church was formed, because he's able to convert an entire congregation in Kirtland, Ohio to Mormonism. So the Mormons go to Kirtland, Ohio, start a bank. There's a lot of financial fraud that goes on, a lot of weirdness, rumors of polygamy start as early as 1831, 1832. Long story short, by 1838, there's financial scandal, a fraudulent bank is created, people lose their life savings. So again, the Mormons have to relocate to Missouri. And then in Missouri, which was where supposed to be, you know, again, Mormons were, what we share with Jehovah's Witnesses is we're called the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Back in the early days of Mormonism, it was all about the second coming. It was all about Jesus coming again. We got to get ready for the second coming. And there were even dates that started to be floated in advance in the early years of the church. And believe it or not, Independence, Missouri, which is where the Mormons relocated to after Ohio, was supposed to be the site of the second coming of Jesus. And it was called Zion, or the New Jerusalem. All of this, it's the same sort of New Testament biblical millennialistic Christianity that influenced the founding of the Jehovah's Witness is the same stuff that influenced Joseph Smith and the early Mormons. So there was all this hype about the second coming and the millennium around Joseph Smith, except for the fact that, again, Joseph Smith and all the Mormons caused all these problems in Missouri. We tried to assassinate the governor of Missouri, which didn't sit well with the Missourians, but also just the way we handled the political, the geopolitical infrastructure and politics in Missouri led us being kicked out of Missouri. Then we went to Illinois, which was the final place before we got kicked out to Utah. And in Illinois is when Joseph Smith started his polygamy sort of really in force. And so he takes 30 or 40 wives, lies about it, creates a militia, creates all this political turmoil and all this polygamous problems. And it ends up with Joseph Smith being killed in 1844 in Nauvoo, Illinois. It's actually Carthage, Illinois, where he was killed. But the town that we created was Nauvoo, Illinois, which at the time rivaled Chicago in size in the early 1840s. So by that time, it's like the third city we had been kicked out of because of all the fraud, because of all the folklore, because of all the polygamy and problems. And that's why we had to go west, is because like we had been kicked out of every town we had settled in. And frankly, Joseph Smith left this trail of carnage wherever he tried to settle a city. Now, he also had a bunch of devout followers that loved him and believed in him. So it's not all bad. And that's part of the thing we always have to try and untangle as Mormons, is there's so much good and then so much horror. And how do you tease the horror from the good? And Mormons, frankly, are still trying to figure that out. But that's how we ended up in Utah. We got kicked out of New York, then Ohio, then Illinois. And finally, after Joseph Smith is killed, it's like, where are we going to go? At the time, Utah was literally Mexican territory, as I understand it. And we thought, we'll just get so far away from America where they can't bug us anymore and we can keep practicing our polygamy. And basically what Brigham Young established in Utah was a theocracy. It was before the Western states had even been colonized. And so he could do whatever he wanted. And in fact, Utah, some would say, remains a theocracy to this day, but certainly in the mid to late 1800s, before we became a state, Utah was a polygamist theocracy in the wild, wild west.
That's amazing. I mean, it's absolutely amazing. In fact, witnesses, they had their little miracle wheat, which of course it didn't work. But let me ask you this, because your church has something very similar to what Jehovah's Witnesses have. In the witness world, we call it new light from Jehovah, where Jehovah God reveals a new teaching. Sometimes when you look behind what caused the teaching to come, you often find that it's typically a government is going to do something to us. And so God talks to us, let us know.
Yeah.
How did, because polygamy was a big part of the Mormon faith, but all of a sudden, what happened? Because now the official teaching of the Mormon faith is there is no polygamy being practiced. We know about the splinter groups, but what was the real reason why all of a sudden God talked to the leaders and told them we got to get rid of it?
Man, you guys do your homework. That is a great question. So one of the weirdest things about Mormonism, and I think you'll agree with this, is the church has made massive changes from its inception until now, but somehow they've been able to convince the members that the church has never changed. And that's a really hard thing to do, and the church is masterful at it. And so polygamy was clearly baked into our founding, and it even gets more intense because it eventually gets put in our scripture. And in fact, to this day, if anybody wants to see if the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints or the Mormon Church is a polygamous church, just Google DNC 132. Doctrine and Covenants is our scripture in addition to the Bible and the Book of Mormon that Mormons view as canonized scripture. And if you go to DNC 132 right now in current Mormon scripture, it talks about plural marriage being part of God's law. So that has not yet been removed from Mormonism. And yet, if you talk to a Mormon leader today, they'll say, oh, that's just something that we did in the past. It was, you know, we're not even sure if it was totally doctrinal, But the true history is really crazy, because not only did Joseph Smith die because of polygamy, and not only did Brigham Young, the second prophet of the Mormon Church, have like 50 wives, but all of the first like six prophets of the church were polygamists. And it got to the point where those prophets would teach the Mormons that polygamy was a requirement to get into the highest degree of heaven, that only polygamists would reach the highest degree of heaven. And we know you guys think a lot about heaven as well, and you guys have a stratified heaven just like us. And so how do we get from polygamy being a founding requirement, prophets doing it, it's in our scriptures, and it's a requirement from heaven, to today where Mormons are like, polygamy, that's those other people, that's not us. Here's what happens. The government starts finding out about it. And even with Abraham Lincoln and subsequent U.S. presidents, they start putting the heat on us, and we start wanting to be admitted to the Union as Western expansion happens, and there are all these benefits to having a state. Utah wants to become a state. We want to seat senators and members of the House of Representatives. We want to benefit from the federal government, and the government's starting to shut us down. So in the 1880s, the government starts sending armies and federal bureau soldiers to literally imprison our prophets and our top our church leaders, because polygamy by that point is illegal. And so the truth is, the federal government put our leaders in prison, seized our property and our assets, and forced us to stop practicing polygamy. And it wasn't until things got super serious in 1890 where the leaders of our church received what they would call divine revelation. And what they issued was what's called the Official Declaration, which was a statement to all the world and to the U.S. federal government and to our own members that God miraculously stepped in and gave our prophets the revelation that polygamy was to be stopped. But there's a big asterisk. They didn't stop it. They just sent people to Mexico, northern Mexico, to keep practicing it. They sent people to southern Canada to keep practicing polygamy. And even in Utah, the Mormon Church lied to the world and to the federal government and to its own members. They kept performing polygamous marriages up into the early 1900s. And so it shows that our church, number one, caves to pressure when it happens, that two, any doctrine can be expendable if the right amount of pressure is applied. Number three, that they would lie to its own members and to the world and to the federal government if they feel like it and if it's expedient. And ultimately, that if they have to make a fundamental change, they're not going to own up to it. They're just going to say God, they're going to put it on God and say, well, God changed his mind, we're just following divine revelation, when in reality, it's government pressure that often causes the change. And this repeats itself in 1978, because prior to 1978, and you guys and I would have talked about this, prior to 1978, people of color were not allowed to be members in full standing in the Mormon church. They weren't allowed to hold the priesthood. The men weren't allowed to hold the priesthood. Men and women weren't allowed to get sealed in the Mormon temples. There was a lot of racist doctrine and teachings for 150 years. And it wasn't until all these universities started protesting Mormonism, our tax exempt status started to get questioned. The civil rights movement came and went, and all this public negative press started bearing down on the Mormon church, where abracadabra, magical world. In 1978, the Mormon prophet Spencer B. Kimball miraculously received the quote revelation that black people of color, in fact, men could receive the priesthood, and men and women could get married and sealed in the temple. But again, it was so conspicuously in response to either governmental pressure or public pressure. But then the brethren just sort of tell the members, that's what God wants. Forget everything we said. This is new revelation. And then they just go ahead and make fundamental changes to the church and blame it on God, basically.
Yeah. See, well, see, yeah.
you guys have a lot. You have a lot going on there, John. And I want to say this. Okay, so when you talk about Charles Taz Russell, and we talk about Joseph Smith, now, you know Charles wrote a lot of books, but then you said somebody killed Joseph. So who wrote the Book of Mormon?
Okay.
Did he write that before he died?
So Joseph Smith would tell you that ancient Native Americans wrote the Book of Mormon. So this is so, you know, science does not hold this belief even possible. But what happened is Joseph Smith claims in 1823 or 4 that an angel came to him and told him that he was a Native American who lived in the Americas around 600 years after Christ died. He died, but before he died, he buried in the hill these golden plates that had been sort of, that represented a 1,000-year history of Native American Christians that lived in Central America, that worshiped Jesus, and that wrote on golden plates and then buried those plates in a hill, but they baptized in the name of Jesus. They confirmed the Holy Ghost based on Jesus. They worshiped Jesus. They taught about Jesus. They taught faith and repentance and baptism, but that they died. The dark Native Americans, here's more racism, that the dark Native Americans killed all the white Native Americans because dark people do bad things according to early Mormon history, but that they buried this record in a hill on these golden plates, that in 1823, this angel Moroni comes to Joseph Smith, says, hey, I'm going to help you uncover these golden plates. So Joseph Smith tells everybody, I'm going to have to get these plates. And then he claims that he went and got them, but no one can see them. And then he claims to have used special powers from God to both pull these plates out of a hill and then translate them from what he claimed was Reformed Egyptian into English. So from about 1827 to 1829, Joseph is telling all his friends and family that he's secretly translating these golden plates from Egyptian into English, but that no one can see the plates because God said that if anyone sees them, they'll die. So he's like putting a sheet over them or burying them in the forest or like looking in his hat with a stone. And he's using scribes to, by his account, translate these golden plates into a book. Whereas I think a more secular version would be he's going off and writing this book and then creating this magical, mystical setup to make people think he's translating an ancient record when in reality he's got his notes in the hat or he's got his notes here on the side. Because he can't write himself. He's not literate enough to actually write a book. So he has to use scribes because his verbal English is amazing, but his written English is horrible. Can't spell, can't write a complete sentence. So he needs a scribe. So he's claiming to be translating golden plates, but in reality, he's probably just dictating from notes, and then his scribes are writing it down. And so by 1829, he completes the Book of Mormon before he even starts the church, and he uses scribes to produce the Book of Mormon. So the Book of Mormon, answer your question, Lady C, the Book of Mormon was completed before the book was ever formed, before the church was ever formed. And what it seems like is, like L. Ron Hubbard, maybe like Charles Taze Russell, he was an author, a fiction author or a spiritual author. And then he said, wait a minute, a church can grow out of this book. And in my view, and in many people's view, the church, the idea of forming a church comes after the book is published. And so that's what happened.
Hope that makes sense. Yeah. Wow. So now in the Jehovah's Witness religion, now the Jehovah's Witness have a very unique way of doing this. They decided to be real slick about how they played theirs. They played both sides of the coin. If you ask a Jehovah's Witness, is the Watchtower publications inspired and infallible? the witness will probably tell you, oh, no, we've never. I can take you all the way back to the early 1800s, 1900s, that we stated this information is not inspired. These books, magazines are not inspired. But here's the catch. They are taught to treat it as if it is so. So although on the outside to the non-witness, they will say it's not inspired, every Jehovah's Witness knows that it is to be treated as if it is. And that's why witnesses have like little statements they'll make. These are divinely provided aids from God. Well, anything divine is inspired. Everybody got that. But the witness is told that in such a subtle way, it doesn't register. Witnesses are told this is manna from Jehovah. Like the Israelites, when they was in the wilderness, this is manna, food from God. And so, of course, that all means it's inspired. And so the Watchtower is able to literally talk out both sides of their mouth. That is one of the things that we often do on our show, is show people how the Watchtower literally, they realize other mistakes that other churches made, and they're like, okay, we ain't going to do that. We're not going to do that. And they actually work it through. And so the witness will tell you, magazine's not inspired, but yet if you question the magazine, it is tantamount to questioning God himself. And so it's an interesting, and they play it on the members, and they are good at it. So as far as you know, the Mormons, they use both the Bible and the Book of Mormon, and what I think you said, the Declaration of Faith.
Doctrine and Covenants, it's Doctrine called. And yeah, Covenants. Doctrine and Covenants, yeah. Yeah, yeah, and there's a very good, strong parallel. And Mormons even take it one step further, maybe, because Mormons teach that the leader of the church is a prophet like unto Moses or Aaron or Daniel or David or, you know, Peter, James, and John. And so Mormons are taught that the current president of the church today, his name is Russell M. Nelson, we're taught that he speaks to God and Jesus directly, right? And so, and that's always been true. And so from Joseph Smith on, you would have leaders say really outrageous and sometimes egregious things. And everyone at the time believes it's Jesus and God talking. So for example, Brigham Young taught a really important teaching in the 1850s, which was people of color don't get to be Mormons in full standing because, you know, Mormons believe that before we existed in this life, Mormons believe that we existed as spirits in what we call a pre-existence. And, but Mormons have to explain why they're discriminating against people of color in the 1850s. And so what Brigham Young taught was that all of us were with God and Jesus in a pre-existence as spirits, but some of us were more righteous than others. And the righteous ones who came down to earth and got to have bodies, they got the white bodies. But the ones that weren't quite as, and I know this is deeply offensive, and I'm really apologizing for my people's past racism.
Hey, there's nothing you can do about it except speak your truth, man. That's all you can do.
Brigham Young taught as doctrine that the people of color that were born into black bodies or Native American bodies, well, the reason why they got the worst situation, it's not because God's unfair. It's not because white people were racist or discriminatory. It's because they weren't as good in the prior life, and that was their consequence.
Yeah.
And I know that's deeply offensive. Now, that teaching was taught as doctrine until the 1960s and 70s, when all of a sudden the civil rights movement happens and the church realizes they've got a real stinker there. But instead of just owning it and saying, hey, we taught you all that stuff, but now we're changing it, what they do is they'll make the change. Well, God says that now people of color can have the priesthood, but they never say we're sorry. And they never say that what was taught in the past was wrong. They just kind of move on, act like it's always been the new way. And then that way they kind of gaslight the members, and then there's never any accountability for the things that were taught as doctrine in the past, as being revelation, as being the very words of God and Jesus. There's never any accountability or apologies. And I think in that sense, we very much share tendencies for our respective former churches.
Oh, absolutely.
It's so interesting. It's very interesting what you're saying. Now, you know, I remember, we're talking about the people of color. Now, growing up, you know, being a woman of color and all that, I remember in the summertime, my coworkers, Caucasian, they would come back from Florida and they would be laying out trying to get a suntan. They come back and they would put their hand up against mine. They say, look, I'm almost as dark as you. Did warmers ever try to get suntans that you know of? I'm just curious.
Yeah, well, I've got, so yes, I think plenty of Mormons felt comfortable getting suntans, but I have a really sad story. We've interviewed on Mormon Stories, my podcast, several Native Americans, and Native Americans have a special place in Mormon history because the Book of Mormon teaches that Native Americans came from Israel, that basically there's a family that left Jerusalem around 600 BC that got on a boat and came to America, populated America, and those are the ancestors of the current Native Americans. And so Joseph Smith and all Mormons are taught that Native Americans are Jewish in their blood, sort of in their blood, right? And so Mormons since Joseph Smith have always believed that Native Americans had the pure blood of Israel, but that they were bad, they were cursed with dark skin because of bad things they did 600 years earlier. And but Joseph Smith predicted that as the Gentiles, us white Mormons, converted the Native Americans who were the true Jews to Mormonism, Joseph Smith taught that they would blossom and that their skin would turn white and delightsome. And so what we have in Mormon history are these teachings that once the Native Americans convert to Mormonism and become super righteous, that their skin would turn white. And so we've interviewed people on Mormon Stories, Native Americans that were raised Mormon, that used to rub lemons on their skin or would stay out of the sun. You know, imagine a 16-year-old Native American Mormon girl growing up in New Mexico. She would rub lemon juice on her skin and avoid going out in the sunlight, or if she did, wear long sleeve shirts because she was hoping for the day where her dark skin would turn white if she was righteous enough, if she was good enough. And that's one of the darkest and saddest parts of our racist past, is how we taught our members, not just our white members, but our members of color, that their dark skin was in essence not beautiful, and in essence was a curse of God, and that if they were righteous enough, their dark skin would turn lighter.
And you know what? That's the reason why I asked you if they try to get suntans, because it's like you got all these people that are racist, but then they'll go out and try to get a suntan.
For sure.
And then they're like, look, I'm almost dark as you. But it's like, if dark skin was so bad, why are you sitting in the sun?
It makes no racism makes no sense on any level.
Yeah.
And it's it's obviously a human problem and an American problem, but it's certainly, it's a bigger Mormon problem than almost any other religion I know.
Yeah, it's interesting that you said that about black people becoming white. It appears as though the Watchtower took a page straight out of from the Mormons, or either the Mormons took a page out of the Watchtower, because that's exactly what the Watchtower used to teach as well, is that once we're in the new system, black folks will become white. That was a basic teaching of Jehovah's Witnesses. And it just simply had nothing, it showed it had nothing to do with God. It was simply someone's own personal racist views. And they just melted it right into the teachings of the church. And then, of course, the issue, like you mentioned before, the different stratas of people in Christianity. And that's why the Witnesses have come up with basically what was known as secondary Christians, those who go to heaven and those who stay on the earth. Those who stayed on the earth, the Watchtower taught for years, these were secondary Christians. Now, everybody knows, it's like if you go buy some secondary on the t-shirts or socks, that little barrel they have, these are second rates. Everybody knows it's not the same as the first rate. And so these are the type of teachings. Now, if you recall, during this period of 1800s, you had Mary Ellen White, you had Charles Taz Russell, you had Joseph Smith, you had all these guys in the 1800s. And this was known in America as the period of enlightenment, which is interesting because it's during that period that a lot of these religions that we see exist today, they all got their start back in those days. And it was always the millennium type, you know, apocalyptic type religions. And these guys have thrived for hundreds of years, all predicting real soon, the world going to end. And so it's amazing. There's a quote that Carl Sagan made about Jehovah's Witnesses, and it's really just so apropos. And that is, he basically said that the leadership of Jehovah's Witnesses, they have contempt for the intelligence of their members because they can tell them anything, anything, and they will believe it. They can change it tomorrow. In our religion, I remember there is a phrase, just to show you how the Watchtower writers, they're very good with words. Words carry tremendous meaning. One of the words that Jehovah's Witnesses use is, this is the truth. I am in the truth. I've been in the truth 22 years. They use that phrase all the time. And it's often interesting how they use it when it comes to doctrines. Jehovah's Witnesses teach what is known as present truth. Present truth. That's what we're teaching right now. But they also have a concept known as past truths. And of course, we know down the road, there'll be future truths. So if you put this on a timeline, as the doctrine becomes a official teaching of the church, it's referred to as being truth. Even when the doctrine is now dropped and discarded, it is often referred to as past truth. So everywhere along the food chain, you keep using the word truth. Never is the word, well, that was a false teaching we taught a few. No. That's past truth. And so it's so amazing how these organizations, they use words. And of course, as we know, words are power. And so by putting in those types of narratives, the faithful Jehovah's Witness, like the faithful Mormon. Oh, OK. And one of the things that the Watchtower is very good at, if you're talking to one of Jehovah's Witnesses and you show them, and we're taught this, if you show them something from an older publication, that's why we laugh that the Watchtower teachings are like milk. They're only good for about 14, 12 days or whatever. But what happens is, if you show a Jehovah's Witness something from an older publication, that will be the first. Well, that's old, man. That was back in the day. Just like you said, exactly the way you said it. Jehovah's Witnesses do it as well. Mormons do it as well. And why? Because they're doing the same thing. They're trying to cover up what is nothing more than a lie. And so they use basically the same techniques. One of the things that I mentioned earlier when I introduced you, I mentioned that you had your degree in psychology. I think it's very important that you share with us how people, because that was one of the things that we did. My wife and I, Lady C and I, we encourage people all the time. If there's nothing else you can do, go get you at least one semester at a community college or whatever, online, of psychology. And that was the first class that we took because we wanted to understand how could people, reasonable people, sound people, logical people, people who could run Fortune 500 companies, how is it they fell for this? And when we started taking our psychology class, the professor really helped us to understand that entire process of how you can be manipulated and just taken right down, you literally just taken round down the road and don't even know you're moving down the road.
And JT, I'll just say amen to what you just said. High demand religions like Scientology, Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormonism, Evangelical Christianity, Orthodox Judaism, it's amazing how much undue influence can be wielded on people and really brilliant people. And in some instances, the smarter you are, the more vulnerable you are to a high demand religion. We can talk about that another time, but I just want to say amen to that. And it's really mind blowing. I love studying psychology and cults. I refer everybody to Stephen Hassan's work on the bite model. And I just recently had someone on Mormon Stories. Her name is their name is Luna Corbden. They have a book called Recovering Agency, which digs into the ways that Mormonism sort of meets criteria for a high demand religion or a cult. I could talk to you guys about that all day, but it's a really important topic, JT. So I'm so glad you brought it up.
Yeah. What I would like to do is, like we've covered a lot of history of those religions, But I would like to know a little bit more about John and him growing up as a Mormon. Like, I know what it was like being in a high control group as one of Jehovah's Witnesses, but I would like to know what it was like for John growing up as a Mormon. That's what I'd like to know. Okay. About that.
That's great. So ladies C, yes, you want to know what it was like to grow up kind of as a Mormon kid?
Absolutely.
Okay. So this is kind of what's really complicating is that if I had to give you one word to describe what it was like to grow up Mormon, my experience was it was wonderful. Now, not all Mormons have a wonderful experience, but because I'm white, because I'm male, because I am tall and, you know, I'm relatively smart and, you know, I got a decent education, and because I'm heterosexual and cisgender, like I had an amazing Mormon upbringing. Like, so I was raised in a family that until my parents got divorced, we all loved each other and we all, you know, as far as I knew, no one was drinking alcohol or getting drunk. As far as I knew, you know, my parents were being faithful to each other. We were all focused on, you know, having dinner every night, about going to church on Sunday, not lying, not stealing, you know, not being mean to each other, not swearing. I grew up never trying alcohol. In fact, I'm 52 years old to this day. I've never tried a drop of alcohol. That's one thing I haven't changed from my Mormon upbringing, but I'd never tried alcohol growing up, never tried a cigarette. I didn't swear growing up at all. I got straight A's in high school. I never had, you know, for us, I was taught no masturbation. So literally I didn't masturbate once, even up through my marriage. So for the first 24 years of my life, that would have not been a part of my life. I didn't have sex before I got married. So there was no STIs, STDs. There was no unwanted pregnancies. And I had this great church community. Not only would I have them on Sunday for 3 hours in church, but I would go to Boy Scouts during the week with other Mormon kids. As a Mormon teen, I would go to Mormon youth dances, temple trips, youth conferences, dance festivals. And then when my parents got divorced, there were several leaders in my local congregation that really took me under their wing, that really helped me. And I graduated from high school, like top of my class, scholarships to college, captain of the varsity basketball team, you know, student body president. It was like a dream. It was like I was a model American kid who was living the American dream. What's not to love? So if I had to, if I had to tell you what it was like to grow up Mormon, it was amazing. Now, was there a dark side? Yes. Stuff going on in my family wasn't like I thought. It turns out that Mormons are really good at hiding things under the surface. So things weren't as good and as happy and as clean and as moral in my family as I thought. My parents got divorced because they weren't really, they were rushed into a marriage. They were rushed into having way too many kids way too quickly, and they weren't prepared for a healthy, happy marriage. So that was a problem. And then also I was taught to be racist. So I was literally taught these racist things. And of course I didn't run around calling people the N-word because that wasn't nice. But did I develop racist beliefs? Probably. And then, you know, homophobia. Like, did I look down on gay people and lesbian people? Absolutely. Did I judge them as being wicked or sinful? Absolutely. And most importantly, I would say the darkest part of my Mormon upbringing, and I think you're going to relate to this, it was believing that everyone in the world who wasn't Mormon was inferior. And JT, I particularly remember you responding to this, but I, on the one hand, I felt like I was lucky enough to be born into God's chosen people. Yes, it was less than one third of one half of 1% of God's people on the earth, because at the time, let's just say 5 or 6 million Mormons with 5 or 6 billion humans. I didn't care. I was one of God's chosen people, and that felt good. And it felt terrible because I look around and I see all these wonderful people and I'm always looking down on them. And I'm always feeling like, well, they're not legitimate Christians. Well, their Christian baptisms don't count in heaven. Well, their Christian marriages don't count in heaven. Well, they're going to the second or the third tier of heaven. I'm going to the first. And even though it felt great to feel superior, I say that in air quotes, it also felt kind of gross to and sad and bigoted to carry this burden of feeling like everyone else was inferior. And on some sense, it just felt wrong because I'd see really smart, good people, and I would have to deal with the cognitive dissonance of thinking that they were all inferior. And that really, it's hard to say why that's a problem, but it wore on me. And all I can say is by the time I'm in my 30s and I'm working for Microsoft, I'm working for MIT, once I lost my faith in Mormonism, it was a huge relief to be able to put down the racism, the bigotry, the homophobia. Let's not forget the sexism, that women were in essence inferior, that they couldn't lead the church, but also just the superiority. It became a burden to me that I'm really sad that I was raised with that worldview. And so for me, that was a lot of the dark side. And then the biggest dark side of all of being raised Mormon is you're raised to a lie. You're raised to think Joseph Smith only had one wife when he had 40. You're raised to think Joseph Smith was the most righteous and good human besides Jesus Christ who ever lived, when he was really a sexual predator. And so you end up giving your life to the church, giving 10% of your income to the church, going on a mission for the church, getting married for eternity in a church when you did not have informed consent, when you were misled and lied to about the church's history. You even go on a mission for 2 years, converting people to a church where you don't even know the basics about the church's true history. And so that is one of the most horrible things about Mormonism, is that people are born into Mormonism or converted to Mormonism, not knowing the true history about Mormonism. And so in essence, they're not only basing their lives on a corrupt, fraudulent lie, but they're converting other people into a corrupt, fraudulent lie, unbeknownst to them and unbeknownst to the people that they convert. And that's the dark side. Now, for me, a lot of the really bad things, like with sexual predators, sexual abuse, the way that gay and lesbian people are treated, women being treated like they're inferior, sexual abuse victims being abused by the church while sexual predators are protected, all that is still something that your church and mine has in common. But I didn't experience that stuff growing up as a Mormon because I was a white, straight male in the church. Okay, so that's, dig in any part you want, but that's my overview of what it was like to be raised as a Mormon.
Yeah, I think the point that you made, you feel superior. Every Jehovah's Witness knows that there are only two sides, outside and everybody else. And so you are a special breed of people. You're a special group of people. Every Jehovah's Witness knows that when they knock on a door and they asked the question, what do you think of this Bible verse here? They could care less. They have no interest in your explanation of what you think it means. They're simply hoping you just keep talking like a good salesman. Everybody in sales knows, as long as you got the guy talking, and he ain't saying no, the conversation continues. So the witness will let the person just talk about what they think the Bible means. He doesn't really care because he's going to give them the actual answer. And so Jehovah's Witnesses have no, I tell people, Jehovah's Witnesses have absolutely no respect for anyone else's biblical knowledge on anything if it contradicts what's published in the Watchtower. Now, if it agrees, oh, it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. But if it disagrees, don't want to hear it. And so what you said is so powerful about being growing up. And most religions, they have that patriarchal type thing, which puts women in their place. That was probably for my wife. That was probably one of the most biggest challenges she had, where she would talk about, you know, you got this little eight, nine-year-old boy who's baptized. And you have, and we had, man, we had sisters in our congregation, man, who were like you. We had sisters who had doctor degrees. And you had a little 8, 9-year-old boy, he got to come in and lead. Like, what is he doing up there? His pants are falling down. But because he is a man, boom, he goes to the front of the line. And so you see the quirkiness, and it really shows you the problem that you have. And like you said, all these other different groups of people. Everybody gets looked down upon except you because you're special. Right. I mean, it's amazing.
And yeah, and you know something too, John, is like you like we didn't celebrate holidays. So did you guys celebrate holidays?
Yeah, Mormons are okay saying the Pledge of Allegiance. Mormons are okay celebrating birthdays and holidays. And we're okay with like medical procedures like blood transfusion and stuff.
Yeah.
Mormons are okay with all that stuff. Yeah.
I think that's why it was so easy for you. Because if you talk to another Caucasian Jehovah's Witness, they're going to say something different because they didn't do all those things. And so they kind of stood out like a sore thumb. Like, you went to college. Yeah. We were encouraged not to go to college. So, you know, so you graduated from Brigham Young, correct?
That's right. That's right.
Now, my question to you on that would be, what type of curriculum? Because, you know, you're looking at this from the standpoint of this is a college or university that is, you know, like your church owns the Mormon church owns that college or that university, right?
That's right. Yeah.
So what was their curriculum like?
So BYU is a unique university. It's a lot like Mormonism's Notre Dame, like Catholicism's Notre Dame. It's always trying to balance faith with scholarship. And the truth is, BYU has some of the strongest academic programs in the United States. So like their accounting program, top two or three in the country, for sure. Some of their business programs, technology programs, their filmmaking program, their graphic design program, their movie animation program, industrial design. There are some top-notch programs. Their law school is generally top 25 in the country. Their business school is generally top 25 in the country or top 50. So you can get an amazing education, even an amazing secular education at Brigham Young University. However, they make you take a bunch of religion classes in addition to your secular classes. So you take a full year of Book of Mormon, two semesters studying the Book of Mormon, a full semester studying New Testament, a full semester studying Old Testament, a full semester studying Doctrine and Covenants, and you know, other types of religion classes as well. The only other thing is BYU historically tends to be very politically conservative, and there always are some controversies. So, for example, when I was at BYU, yes, there were biology professors that taught that evolution was true because they're biology professors, and there's no reputable biology PhD in the world that doesn't believe in evolution at this point. So you would get these mixed messages where the secular subjects would sometimes teach, or like Age of the Earth, geologists would teach that the Earth was billions of years old, but Mormon Doctrine and Covenants teaches that the Earth is 6,000 years old. And geologists would say that an Adam and Eve 6,000 years ago and a global flood with Noah, well, that doesn't really fit with the archaeological record. But then you'd have religion professors teaching, yep, the Earth is 6,000 years old, evolution is evil, Adam and Eve were the first humans on the Earth, and there was a global flood where all the animals fit in the ark. And so you would get this weird whiplash of like credible secular science-based knowledge, and then religion professors who would criticize the secular professors and tell you that that learning is evil and don't pay too much attention to what those scientists are teaching because God's rules trump, you know, the learnings of men. So in some sense, it was a bit of a bipolar whiplash type of an education that that was problematic. And even to this day, you'll get academic freedom issues at BYU where if a professor, you know, so like it's demonstrable that the Book of Mormon is not a historical record of Native Americans. You can prove that geographically. You can prove that linguistically. You can prove that genetically now through DNA evidence. Native Americans aren't Jewish. Like there's DNA evidence to show that they came from Asia. So any scientist can disprove the historicity of the Book of Mormon. But if a professor would ever talk about that, they would get fired from BYU. And again, with LGBT issues, you've got a lot of professors now that know that being gay isn't a choice, that know that it's something where usually your sexuality is determined or your gender identity is determined once you come out of the womb. And so you'll get professors that want to be progressive about LGBT issues, but then you get religion faculty saying there's only one type of marriage. It's marriage between a man and a woman, and being gay is a sin. And so BYU, even to this day, kind of has this civil war where how religious can it be? How secular can it be? And you've always got professors afraid to tell the truth and always professors being kicked out if they teach something that contradicts longstanding religious views.
Well, that's very interesting. And so based on those things that you just got to saying, what about shunning? Do you guys practice shunning? And if you do, is it hard shunning, soft shunning? What does that look like in the Mormon faith?
So this is one area where Scientologists and Jehovah's Witnesses on average are actually worse than us. So there are many areas where I'd say we can match almost anybody. Like financial demands, we require 10% of our membership, 10% of the income of our membership for life. Our patriarchy is as rigid as almost anyone's, including the Catholic Church and you guys. But in terms of shunning, Mormons are get a B, whereas Jehovah's Witnesses and Scientologists get an A. Mormons, hard shunning is still happens in Mormonism. You can get divorced by your spouse if you lose your faith in Mormonism. Absolutely happens every single day. You can have parents disowning kids if they lose their faith. Absolutely happens. You can have siblings cutting off other siblings once they lose their faith. So hard shunning exists, but I wouldn't say it's the norm. It's, let's just say it happens 10% of the time, maybe 20% of the time. The norm is what I call soft shunning, which is like, okay, your marriage is ruined, but maybe your spouse will stay with you, but they'll look at you as a disappointment for the rest of your life. And so you're, if you lose your faith, you're, if you either have to get divorced because you can't live together anymore, or you have to live in a marriage where your spouse views you as an eternal disappointment and like you broke the contract. With your parents, they may not disown you 75% of the time, but they'll, you could win the Nobel Peace Prize or cure cancer, and your parents are going to like shake their heads at you and say, what a disappointment. You left the covenant path, and now you've made heaven sad because now you're not going to be with us in the highest degree of heaven, and you've ruined our family's cohesion because you left the faith.
How did things look for your family? When you woke up and you began to say, I don't want this religion anymore, what happened with your family? Did you get, did they shun you? Did you?
So
you
know, I'm one of the lucky ones.
Yeah. Okay.
And the only reason I was able to do Mormon Stories podcast is because I knew I had the type of parents. I sort of won the Mormon lottery. Literally less than 1% of Mormons are going to be able to tell you what I'm about to tell you, which is that once I lost my faith, I knew that my particular parents were going to love me no matter what, and that they were never going to shun me or cut me off. In fact, I was excommunicated by the Mormon Church in 2015 because of my podcast and because of the things that I said publicly in support of women's rights, in support of LGBT rights, and talking about the church's problems. When I was excommunicated, I had this big council with 15 white men that held a court to excommunicate me. I asked my mom and dad and brother to testify as witnesses on my behalf, and they all did. So that's how remarkable my parents are. Now, having said that, my sisters were disappointed in me. I never was able to have the level of intimacy with my sisters that I had before I lost my faith. There are other in-laws and direct family members that for all intents and purposes have cut me off completely. They don't talk to me. If I come to their house, they leave. They tell their family members they'd rather me not come to their house, and they haven't spoken to me in 10 or 15 years at all. And so I've experienced everything from no shunning with my parents and my brother to soft shunning to many immediate family members and in-laws to hard shunning. For me, it's run the gamut, but I'm one of the more lucky ones, I would have to say.
But John, do you think that because your sisters are older than you and you and your brother are closer in age that they didn't have the closeness because they had already left the house when you were born?
So that's probably part of it. My oldest two siblings are sisters. My oldest sister passed away about 4 or 5 years ago, and she has her own interesting story about what I think happened in her life. But it just drove a big wedge between us. And part of it was because for her, she was a different Mormon youth than me. My oldest sister, Gina, she partied as a kid. She was a hippie growing up in the 60s and 70s. She tried marijuana. She smoked as a teen. And the Mormon church didn't work for her in a lot of ways. And she ended up marrying a non-Mormon, which was a big deal. And then she got active. But I think that she saw her life go in bad places when she wasn't a faithful Mormon. And so for her, being a Mormon was like the way she wouldn't get into trouble again like she did as a young adult. And so she needed Mormonism to like just feel good in the world. And so when it was a bit of a wedge between, and I think it's the same thing with my other sister, I just think that they need to believe in Mormonism just to like not be depressed, to not be too anxious, to keep keep a sense that life has meaning and purpose and joy. And they just had invested so much in it. I just don't think they've ever been willing to consider that it wasn't true. So for them, if it's hurt our relationship, it's not because they're mean. It's not because they didn't love me. It's because I think they were afraid that if they learned too much or talked to me too much or empathized too much with me, that their whole world would unravel. And so I think they were afraid. And my sister, we have a relationship now. It's been strained by Mormonism. But we still have a relationship. It's just been strained. And not because she's not a great person. I just think she's afraid, honestly. And with my brother, I don't want to talk about his situation too much other than to say he and I view things almost identically now. Okay. He's still a member. He's not been excommunicated. He hasn't left the church. He still attends. His wife is still a believer, and many of his kids are still believers. Mm-hmm. So he's trying to navigate what's called a mixed faith marriage. Whereas my wife, Margie, resigned from the church the day after I was excommunicated. So my brother, we see things very similarly, mm-hmm. but we're closer because we see things similarly, but he has to be careful because his wife is still an Orthodox believer.
And many know about that. John, I got to ask you, and then this is the question that everybody often asks because they want to know. Every religion has some very unusual peculiarities about the things that they do. Could you explain to us what is the deal with the magic underwear?
I love that question. So temple garments, everything Joseph Smith came up with, he kind of read somewhere in the Bible, usually in the Old Testament, and then he found some way to work it in. But somehow Joseph Smith got the idea that like Jewish priests had special clothing that they would wear in the temple to officiate in the offices of the priesthood. I don't know exactly where he got the idea. What I do know is that Joseph Smith was a Mason. So if you've heard of the Masonic Lodge, Joseph Smith was a Mason, and a big part of what ended up becoming garments was Joseph Smith being a Mason, going through the Mason temple ceremony and the Mason rituals, and then creating a temple ritual for Mormons as a part of the temple called the endowment ceremony. So basically Joseph's like, okay, I want a temple endowment ceremony. I'm going to borrow a lot of this from the Masons, but then I need some sacred clothing for our most faithful members so that they can, feel extra special, extra sacred, extra close to God. And so Joseph came up with the idea of the garment or the garments. And these at the time were kind of, think of them as white long johns, white long underwear that you wore under your clothes and that had three marks, a compass, a square, and then another mark. And guess what? Compass and square, anybody who knows the Masonic symbols, who's seen that Masonic G, they'll also see a compass that goes over it and a square, because those are the tools of the Mason. And so one thing you need to know about the Mormon sacred underwear or the Mormon garments is two of the three markings, I think all three of the markings, are Masonic markings that were borrowed from the Masonic ritual. So the underwear, the white underwear that Mormons wear, have a compass sewed into them and a square sewed into them that we got from the Masonic Lodge. But Joseph Smith started that. It used to be long underwear. You got the garments when you went through the temple to take out what's called your endowment. And your endowment is where you promise to God to pay your tithing, to obey the law of chastity, which meant to not have sex with anyone other than your spouse, and to consecrate, to obey God, to which meant to obey the church and its leaders, and to consecrate your life to the church. So the garments are there primarily to remind you of the promises you make when you go through the temple, to pay your tithing, to never cheat on your spouse, and to give everything to the church, even your life if necessary. So when a Mormon wears the sacred underwear, the garments, what they're wearing that for is to remind them of the promises they made in the temple. Now, really quickly, over the past 200 years, as clothing has gotten more modern, sleeves have gotten shorter, skirts have gotten shorter, shorts got, you know, invented at some point. Ironically, coincidentally, the garments got shorter and shorter and shorter, even though Joseph would have taught that these long John garments are the garments of God, and this was revealed to me by God, and this is what God wants. Conveniently, as dress standards in America changed, you saw garments getting lighter, getting thinner, getting shorter, such that by the 1960s and 70s and 80s, they just became normal t-shirts that you'd wear under your clothes and kind of long boxer shorts that you would wear under your pants, women too. And so that's what it is today. They're these super uncomfortable boxer shorts and or t-shirts that Mormon men and women wear after they go to the temple. And it's all, if you come to Utah and you go to any social event where the women are dressed up, and the women are trying to wear skirts that aren't super long, but that are modern in fit, they'll come up to their knee, but if they sit down, you'll see the white garments poking out of the skirts of the women. If men try and wear shorts with their garments, you'll see the white garments poking out of the shorts or poking out of the sleeves, or you'll see like what's called the celestial smile. You'll see an undershirt under the shirt or the blouse of a man or a woman. That's their garments. But trying to be sensitive to Mormons, they're very sacred, and they are viewed as like a protection, like a spiritual protection. I was taught growing up that you know, there was Mormon folklore that, like, Mormon soldier fighting in World War II gets shot by a gun, but because he's wearing garments, the bullet ricochets. Or Mormon working in a steel mill falls into the vat of steel, but because he's wearing his garments, he's protected by God. Like, there's that lore in Mormonism that it's a physical protection, but more often it's more the story of, you know, Mormon husband was on a business trip, took off his garments, went to a bar, and then cheated on his wife because he wasn't wearing the spiritual protection of the garment.
Okay. But let me ask you this. I didn't realize women wore the garment.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, was it all one piece?
It used to be one piece. And then as fashion standards changed, it became two piece. And then the sleeves got shorter and the fabric got thinner. And nowadays the church is trying to find a way to create garments where you don't even really know their garments, because honestly, it's one of those things that Gen Zers and millennials, they're just not buying this dress standard.
That is crazy. Well, do you have to have a criteria like be baptized to have it?
Yeah. So baptism is the lowest sort of thing you need to do to become like a class one Mormon. To become a full class Mormon, you got to go through the temple. Usually you serve a mission and then you get married in the temple. And it's through that process of going to the temple, getting your garments, making these covenants, going on a mission, marrying the temple, where you have met the criteria to reach the highest degree of heaven. So literally, if you don't wear the garments and get married in the temple as a Mormon, you will never reach the highest degree of heaven, and you'll never become what the Mormon Church teaches us internally. You'll never become a god. And by the way, I have to really make this point. Guess the one, other than like not having premarital sex or extramarital sex, guess what the one requirement is to be able to go to the temple and wear the garments? I just want, of all the commandments, loving your neighbor, doing charity, doing service, being, you know, not sexually molesting kids, not cheating on your spouse, there's one requirement that is connected to temple attendance, to temple marriage, to every aspect of the temple, which is then connected to being in the highest degree of the celestial kingdom. Can you guys guess what that one absolute fixed requirement is?
Go for it, JT.
If I had to guess,
one requirement, what is it?
If I had to guess, it's probably the 10% rule.
It's the money. That's Tom Cruise. Show me the money. You can't go to
that. What was that? What that movie? Show me the money.
Jerry Maguire. Yeah,
show me the money. Show me the money.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. You can't reach highest degree of Mormon heaven without paying 10% of your income to the church for your entire life. And in fact, let's just say you grow up as a Mormon, you don't pay your tithing anymore, but your kids are still Mormon. When they go to the temple to get married, if you're not paying the church 10%, even if you're an active Mormon, you can't attend your own children's wedding if you're not paying the money.
Wow.
So that's why the Mormon church, you know, you guys may be a multi-billion dollar organization. The Scientologists may be a multi-billion dollar organization. The Mormon Church is a multi-hundred billion dollar organization. The Mormon Church is probably worth $500 billion right now in 2021. And estimates are that within 20 years, if we're not already a trillion-dollar church, we will be in the next 20 years. That's how successful and rich and wealthy the Mormon Church is. It is on record that the church has well over $100 billion in cash, real estate, and stock portfolio. And the Mormon Church today owns somewhere between 2 and 4% of the publicly available land in the state of Florida. Can you imagine 2 to 4% of the state of Florida? Guess who owns it? We do. I say we. It's our
amazing
church.
Oh, I know. Yeah, I know.
But you know what? You know what I would like to know. You know, when I listen to what you're saying about the Mormons and all these, because it sounds like it's a lot of rituals and superstitions and stuff, and all these different levels. How do you process that? You know, when you wake up in the morning and you think about all the things that you're required to do in this religion, do you ever get a chance to like chill out in your thoughts?
So yeah, I think one of the things, you know, you guys are always like being missionaries, going door to door. All your free time is either going to church, studying the word, or like being a missionary. But one of the things high demand religions do is they keep you so busy, you don't even have time to question the church. And you're so busy, you wouldn't even want to because your life is so full. So the Mormon Church has you praying when you wake up, reading your scriptures when you wake up, having family prayer, having family scripture study, having lots of kids so that you're having to have a job where you're working 40, 50, 60 hours a week just to make enough money to feed the 4 to 8 kids that you have. Plus, you and your spouse are serving in what's called callings in the church. There's no paid at the local congregational level. There's no paid clergy. So we don't have professional priests that get paid. Mormons are running the church. And it's multiple hours on Sunday, plus the youth programs during the week. And plus you're trying to raise all these kids. The Mormon church keeps you so busy, you don't have time to learn about all the problems with the church, or time or even interest to question the problems in the church. And by the way, I had a friend put together a list of all the things you're supposed to do as a Mormon. Keep a journal, keep a garden, keep a 1 year's food storage, just serve in all your callings in the church, do home teaching where you're visiting the members, be a missionary. Like, the Mormon church keeps you so incredibly busy. You could literally be and do Mormon stuff and your job and your family stuff 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for the 100 years that you live. It is not just a belief system. It is a lifestyle. It is a comprehensive, all-consuming lifestyle. And that's what people don't get. People are like, you know, a Lutheran or a Methodist, you guys will get this. A Lutheran or a Methodist will go, oh, you want to leave your church? Just leave your church. Not in our church, not in your church, not in my church.
No.
It's like cutting off your arms and legs.
Yeah, it is.
To leave Mormonism.
Yeah. One of the things I will say, which is very interesting about the Mormon, and this is probably the worst part of the Jehovah's Witnesses. In fact, I would say it's got to be the worst part. And that is the issue of education. In your church, you are allowed, and your church puts forth a system so that the members can get an education and become doctors, lawyers, dentists, teachers, professional people, so they can go out and make money. Of course, they want you to give 10% back. But when you have members who make a lot of money, then they have money that they can give. When you are one of Jehovah's Witnesses, because Jehovah's Witnesses are discouraged from going to school, getting an education, your organization ends up with a lot of broke people, people who barely have enough to make it for themselves. And what happens is, in your case, if there's any silver lining, as I'm looking at what you talked about, if there's any silver lining, when you leave the Mormon church, especially if you went on to Brigham Young and so forth, you at least can take away your skill set and you can start over again. It's very unfortunate, man. And I'll be honest with you, for a Jehovah's Witness who leaves this organization, who didn't go to school, who had opportunities to go, there's so many witness kids who get free scholarships, they end up turning them down. And so when they leave, like myself and my wife and others, when we leave this religion, I mean, we literally leave this religion with nothing, nothing. And that's one of the things that the people who are watching this video, and you'll see how they'll post about it, how that when we left with nothing. At least you were able to walk away with some skills, some training that now you can take it and roll with it. But these high control groups, like you've said, and we discussed, they touch people's lives. And if you're not part of, if you're a Baptist or a Lutheran, you have no idea what it means to leave one of these types of groups. I mean, it's devastating.
JT, definitely. If you don't mind, I just want to give a quick response to that. So first of all, when I see, you know, Scientology and Jehovah's Witnesses and others, Orthodox Jews, have it worse, my heart goes out. Like the imprisonments and the beatings of Scientology, the stuff that goes on with the Sea Org, the stuff that David Miscavige has done with his wife disappearing, and to this day, no one knows. Like, there are things about Scientology that are worse than anything I've ever experienced or that is normally experienced. When I hear about Jehovah's Witnesses being discouraged from getting an education, it is heart-wrenching to me. And I or not being able to have a blood transfusion, you know, like that's some serious stuff. And it makes me sad. So I want to give you a 50% validation on that, JT. And let me just tell you why. Mormon men have it way better than adult Jehovah's Witnesses, because Mormon men, by and large, become very successful in the business world, a lot like the perception or the stereotype of Jewish people, frankly. The only one tiny correction I want to make is with half of our adult population, because JT, Mormon women are pretty much these days discouraged from an education, just like Jehovah's Witnesses.
Oh,
they're
man.
Told you don't really, you know, okay, go to college, but the main reason wow. you're going to college, Mormon women, is to marry a Mormon man. And if you don't finish your school, no big deal. You're going to be a housewife. You're going to be raising your kids. So go ahead. If you want to get an elementary ed degree or a homemaking degree or whatever silly degree you want to get, I guess go ahead and get it. But that's not what your life's about. Your life is about, and this is what happens, many, many, many Mormon women may go to BYU or BYU Idaho or BYU Hawaii. They may, you know, go for a year or two, but it's called your MRS degree, right? It's you go there until you find your return missionary, and then you marry them, and then you start having babies as soon as you can. And for me, the horrific collateral damage is now in 2021, we're seeing this massive epidemic of Mormons learning that they've been misled about the church, losing their faith in the church. But now it's in their 30s when they've, you know, married, they've given up their educations, they've given up, the women have given up their educations, they've given up their careers, they've already had three or four kids. Now they're discovering in their 30s or 40s that they were living a lie, but they never got their degrees, they never got their careers. And then their marriage falls apart because the whole marriage was based on the religion. And then you've got this divorced Mormon mom who's in her late 20s or 30s or 40s or sometimes 50s, who now her husband may or may not pay alimony, may or may not pay child support. She's got to figure out a way to enter into the workforce as a woman in her 30s, as a single mom in her 30s or 40s or 50s with no career to speak of, no education to speak of. And it is a heart-wrenching travesty to see the collateral damage that is, in many instances, the divorced single adult Mormon mom in the modern era. So yes, JT, you guys have it worse than us.
Wow, man. I had no idea.
The divorced single mom.
I'm gonna tell you, I'm gonna tell you, man, and I'll be very frank. For women, historically, religious belief systems have shafted women. I mean, they get cut off at the knees, the ankles, and the toenails. I mean, everything, man.
Worse than men of color.
I mean, women just, I mean, I look, for example, in the African-American community, just in general, black women fill the churches, man. Pastor riding around in Rolls Royces and stuff. And I mean, it's women just get cut short. And so this religious belief system, many times, it takes people who are good people, sincere people, and give them a false value system. Because basically, this is the bottom line. God wants you to do this. And once you convince a person they're doing something for God, like the Apostle Paul said, they would deliver you up one day and kill you and think they did a service to God. Once you convince a man or woman that their actions is at the direction of God, man, that's a person you cannot control. You can't do nothing with. Not a thing.
That's amazing.
Lady C, I'll just say this really quick, and then I believe in religious freedom in the sense that, like, we can't make religion illegal, and it shouldn't be the government's role to be like regulating religion. But I do think one thing should literally be illegal, and I think you guys may agree with this. I think it should be illegal in the United States for anyone to claim to be communicating with God on the behalf of another person, because it's too much power. I don't care if it's a priest or a pastor. I don't care if it's a crystal ball seance person. No one should be allowed to say, hey, God or spirits or angels are speaking to me on your behalf, because it is requirement number one for any cult, any abuse, any, you know, ecclesiastical abuse. It all starts with somebody saying, God and the angels aren't talking to you, but they're talking to me for you. Now let me tell you what they have to say. In my view, that's too much power. That's like adults shouldn't marry children. No person should ever claim to be speaking for God on the behalf of somebody else. It should be illegal, because it's just it's too much power, and there's too much abuse that comes from it.
John, what did we say at the very beginning of the program? Power corrupts, and absolute power absolutely corrupts.
Absolutely.
That is so interesting. Wow. I want to, you know, you can talk about.
Let's do a series.
John.
I know, right?
Let me tell you something right now. John,
this has
you
been
got
very
it going
enlightening,
on,
man.
Because you know a lot. I mean, you really have broken it down.
You sure did, man. I tell you, man.
If anybody, that everybody got to listen to this program because John has broken it down. You have given us a true history about the Mormon church. I didn't know all that stuff was going on.
I didn't either. Man.
You know? Whoa. And I'm interested to know how old is the average person that's waking up in the year 2021? What's the average age?
That's a great question. So if we were to go back 10 or 15 years, the epidemic in Mormonism, because let's be clear, this is not just a Mormon problem. This is not just a Jehovah's Witness problem. If you go to the Pew Foundation, that's P-E-W, just Google Rise of the Nuns, N-O-N-E-S. Religion is in decline in the developed world, and especially in the United States. The largest and the fastest growing religious group in the United States, according to the Pew Foundation, is those who no longer affiliate with any religion. So it's now over a quarter of the American population no longer affiliates with any religion at all. And if you take any Orthodox religion, and sorry, any Protestant religion, Lutheran, Presbyterian, Episcopalian, Methodist, all in decline. Yeah. And Mormonism is in massive decline. So there is a broader, and I think the internet has a big, is a big contributor to this. You know, religion's on the ropes in general. But if you go back 10 or 15 years in Mormonism, it was mostly people in the 40s and 50s who were like studying the internet who were losing their faith. But it has only been in the past 10 or 15 years that we've seen kind of the 20 and 30 somethings leave in massive amounts. And so, but they're different things now. Those of us in the 30s, 40s, and 50s who have left are leaving Mormonism are leaving mostly because we were taught a version of history that is fraudulent and demonstrably false. And the internet helped us figure that out. And then once we started talking about it and telling other people, it caused a bunch of us older people to leave because we felt deceived and lied to. The younger generation, the teens, the Gen Z people, the millennials, the people in their teens and 20s and early 30s, they're not leaving because they were lied to and misled. They're leaving, number one, because the church is boring, because the church is irrelevant, because the church is tedious, because they have social media that they'd much rather tune into, and because the church is racist and sexist and homophobic, and Gen Zers just aren't going to put up with racism, sexism, and homophobia and transphobia like, frankly, a lot of us who were raised and who were older were somehow willing to tolerate. And so the Mormon church is really losing its 30 and 40. It's losing its 30 and 40 and 50 somethings. It's really losing its 20 somethings. There are estimates that up to 80% of the kids in the United States raised Mormon who served missions are leaving the church now. By the time they're 30, up to 80% are leaving the church. So I'm going to tell you this right now. The Mormon church in the United States and in Europe is hemorrhaging. It is in free fall. You're seeing wards and stakes and chapels being sold, units collapsing. The number of Mormon missionaries has gone from 90,000 to 80,000. It's down to 50,000 in a year's time. And the church, by within 10 to 20 years, the Mormon church will actually be in numerical decline in Utah and in the United States. The only thing that's propping up the Mormon growth rate is its birth rate, because we still have three kids on average. And Africa. So the Mormon Church sees the writing on the wall that in Latin America, in Europe, and in Asia, in the United States and Canada, the church is in free fall. So guess what it's doing? This is like offensive and harsh. They're going to Africa where they can still deceive and fool people and lure people in with the lure of wealth and status and education. And so the church is going bananas in Africa where they're frankly in sub-Saharan Africa, where people are frankly desperate to get an education, to get financial support. And I, you know, who knows whether to say that's good or bad. What I can say is the Mormon church is no longer a marketable product in the developed world, and it's in decline. They have to go to Africa to grow their membership now.
Yeah, that's the way it is with Jehovah's Witnesses as well. In practically all the Western countries, especially countries that have great internet access, there's absolutely no growth. I mean, it is totally stagnant. Yep. Taking out Latin America and much of the African continent, there would be absolutely no growth at all for Jehovah's Witnesses.
We're even dying in Latin America, which is really unbelievable.
Wow. But the attention,
you know, we have probably almost half our membership on the rolls is in Latin America, but like only 10% of the Latin Americans baptized Mormon actually attend church or identify as Mormon. So the Mormon church boasts 16 million members. Never let that fool you. There are probably only 3 to 4 million Mormons who actually identify as Mormon in the world. The Mormon church is super rich. It's almost a $1 trillion organization, but it's only about a 4 million member church across the world. So don't let those numbers fool you, people.
Yeah. And the same, it's interesting. That's interesting you made that point, because the same thing with Jehovah's Witnesses. The Watchtower counts the number of publishers, and they base it on who actually goes out and knocks on doors or who turns in what's called time. So when you report how much time or how many hours you spent knocking on doors, they will count you. And what they have been doing in the last few years, they have literally been removing the requirement of having to count time. Right now, as we're speaking right now, the official position right now is if someone asks you how much time do you have, you just say, I was out. I talked to some folks, and they get to be counted as a publisher, which keeps the numbers up high. We've done a couple of videos how the Watchtower plays the number games, and the basis is like, you know, numbers don't lie, but you can lie with numbers. And that's what they do. Now, here's the kicker, John. And this is the same thing for Jehovah's Witnesses as for you and the Mormons. While there may be growth in these countries, there's no money. There's no money. The Mormon church is used to having well-to-do people like we see often on television and in politics who are financially well off, who can cut real nice checks. When these new members from Africa come in, they won't be cutting these million-dollar checks.
So let me tell you, so this is interesting. Two things. This is so fascinating. Thanks for bringing this up. And I think you guys are going to like this. Number one, the Mormon church is so wealthy now, okay? So it's estimated that the annual operating budget of the Mormon church is something like $6 or $7 billion a year, okay? That's how much it takes to run the Mormon church, okay? It is estimated right now that just with the cash, real estate, stocks, and bonds that the Mormon church holds in its possession, which now is over $150 billion minimum, okay, that the church, if it only gets a 7% return on its investment, can fully fund the annual operations of the church just off the interest of its financial investments. So the Mormon church is going to become a $1 trillion organization.
Self-sustained.
Mm-hmm. While it's shrinking in membership, while it's dying, it's going to become a $1 trillion organization.
Oh,
and then the only other thing is, the way the church has set up its growth in Africa is it's not investing in Africa. It basically tells the leadership there, look, whatever you guys want to collect, you can keep to run the church. But don't expect us to be giving you money. You figure out how to run your local churches with whatever money you can get. But other than building temples, the church has set it up so it's not sharing its wealth to educate, to give, you know, to build schools there, to build water there, to build literacy there. It is doing online education, and that's the way, that's the service that's offering to Africans is online education, but it is not investing in lots of chapels, lots of infrastructure. It's basically saying, figure out the money stuff. We're keeping our money. We're going to keep getting rich, and you guys figure out how to make the money.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing.
I mean, I'm going to tell you, man, I think these guys must go to the same conferences. Because I'm serious, man.
Sure,
because
yeah.
Right now, just a little FYI, right now the Watchtower is in the process of literally all around the world consolidating congregations and selling Kingdom Hall. They have been selling Kingdom Hall, and these are like, and they'll go into like a major city, Kingdom Hall is like $1 million, and they're just bouncing these Kingdom Halls all around the world. They are literally taking two and three congregations, putting them into one building and selling the other three. I mean, the money, same. I mean, it's a shame.
Isn't it fascinating?
It is. It's really fascinating.
Yeah.
It really is fascinating.
I mean, yeah. And our lawyers, they have to go to like, I want to say cult lawyer school, but like high demand religion lawyer school, because our lawyers know how to suppress people who claim sexual abuse and protect the church and protect sexual abusers so that the church doesn't get awful lawsuits. I am sure that our lawyers share notes, our church's lawyers.
I'm sure they do.
And marketing and PR. And
if we were to find out that they do, we would not be shocked. That's what I always say. If I were to find out that they do, I wouldn't be shocked at all.
Scientologists too. Like there has to be somewhere the secret meeting of Scientologists,
I control group lawyers.
It's amazing. Now, John, are you? Is the Mormons the one that does all the baptizing?
Yeah,
the dead ancestors
in our temples. So Joseph Smith had to figure out this problem of what happens to all the people in the world. See, Mormons won't admit this, but this is 100% true. There is not a baptism that's ever been performed in the history of post-Jesus Christianity that's valid according to the Mormon church, other than a Mormon baptism. Mormons believe they're the only ones authorized after Jesus to baptize in the name of Jesus. So every Catholic baptism, every Jehovah's Witness baptism, I think you guys baptize, I'm pretty sure you do.
Yeah.
Every Baptist baptism is illegitimate in the eyes of the Mormon church from Jesus to now. So Joseph Smith had to figure out, well, what do we do if baptism is required for heaven? And only Mormon baptisms count, or Jesus baptisms. How do we get other people into heaven? And so Joseph Smith came up with the idea, I know what we'll do is we'll allow living Mormons to get baptized on behalf of dead Christians that didn't get a Mormon baptism. So one of the things that happens in a Mormon temple is that Mormon youth and Mormon adults go to the temple and they get a little slip of paper, they dress in white, they go into a little baptismal font, and they got a little piece of paper that says, like, Jose Alvarado, born, 1942, died 1975. And a Mormon youth will stand in a baptismal font in white clothes, in water, and a Mormon man will raise his arm to the square and say, John Smith, in the name of Jesus Christ, I baptize you in the name of this Jose Alvarado who is dead. And they'll be baptized in a Mormon temple for this dead person who died a long time ago.
Wow.
That happens every single day. If you go to any of these Mormon temples, Washington, D.C., Salt Lake City, Dallas, Berlin, doesn't matter. Every day in one of those Mormon temples, dead people who have died are being baptized by a living Mormon person. And that is one of the things that is a part of the Mormon temples.
When you're driving the Beltway here in Washington, D.C., you can see the Mormon.
I was married in that temple.
Oh, really?
If you're driving the Beltway in the morning, when the sun hits that bad boy, you can't see nothing, man. It will blind you. But I do have a question. Most churches, let me ask you a question though. Most churches are open. There's a couple of times service on Sunday. Can a person just stop by? Let's just go to visit their service zone. Say, can you just walk into a Mormon church and sit down and listen to the minister preach?
Okay. So in Mormonism, there's a difference between a chapel and a temple. So the chapel is the ward, is the building where congregations meet every Sunday. And if you go to any Mormon chapel, it says visitors welcome on the side, and anyone can come in and attend a Mormon church ceremony.
Okay.
So yes, the Mormon temples, there's a yes and a no there. All Mormon temples have what are called visitor centers. So that Washington, D.C. temple has what's called a visitor center, and there'll be missionaries there that will welcome you in, talk to you about the church. Maybe there's a big statue of Jesus. Maybe there's some movies they'll show you. But Mormons will absolutely use their temples as a way to do missionary work. And so, yes, anyone can walk into a Mormon temple, go into the visitor center, and talk to missionaries about how they need to be Mormons. Yes, but to go into the actual temple and see the temple marriages or the temple weddings or the baptisms for the dead.
Oh, wow.
You got to be a baptized Mormon. You got to pay your money, and you have to be worthy, which means you have to, like, you know, not you know, cheat on your spouse, not drink tea, drink coffee.
Never been smoking in the last couple of days.
Not drink alcohol, not do drugs. Yeah. The church has a bunch of behavioral rules.
Yeah, behavior, yeah. I like that. Behavioral rules.
You have to comply with to go to the temple.
Amazing.
Man,
when do they start doing all this no caffeine, no alcohol and stuff like that? Has it always been like that with the church?
So this is another really fascinating thing. So Joseph Smith came up with the revelation that, you know, hard liquor was not good for the body, and that things like wine and beer should be consumed moderately, and that hot drinks, he said, were not good for the body, and the tobacco wasn't good for the body. But when he received that revelation, it was called a word of wisdom by advisement only. So Joseph Smith himself drank alcohol. Joseph Smith himself drank wine the night before he was martyred. Brigham Young owned distilleries or wineries, and the early members of the church drank coffee, you know, used tobacco, drank alcohol all the way through to the early 1900s, coffee and tea, all that. But for some reason in like the 1910s or 20s, the church decided to turn what was just kind of a recommendation into hard and fast, strict requirements. And we think it's because our identity used to be polygamy. But once the church gave up polygamy, if you look at all the old Mormon polygamists, they always had mustaches and beards. They dressed in these old clothes. And that's what the old Mormon persona looked like. Once we gave up polygamy and wanted to be known for something differently, we basically took on the IBM persona. White shirts, ties, clean-cut hair, normal Donnie and Marie looking people. And we adopted this health code that used to just be a recommendation. We adopted it as a strict code of living. So it wasn't until the teens and 20s that coffee and tea and alcohol and tobacco became strictly forbidden. And if you fast forward now, Mormons don't even know that Joseph Smith drank wine the night before he was killed. They don't know that the first six or seven prophets, seers, and revelators chewed tobacco or drank wine or drank coffee. Mormons don't even know their own history.
Yeah.
And that's one of the weird evolutions that's more of a modern phenomenon where the history is kept from the members.
That's so crazy. Do you know how Joseph Smith was killed?
Yeah. Yeah. So this is like dark and really kind of tragically comic. So when the Mormons finally end up in Nauvoo, Illinois, which is kind of southern Illinois, after they'd been kicked out of New York and Ohio and Missouri, they end up in Illinois. And this is when Joseph Smith secretly starts taking all his wives. So he had done some polygamy in the 1830s, but starting with 1840 in Illinois is when he really started marrying 14-year-olds, other men's wives, mother-daughter pairs, sister pairs. But it's all secret. He's not even telling Mormons that he's doing this. So, and he's not even telling all of the top leadership. So he's only got this inner circle of trusted leaders that he's even telling about his polygamy. Whereas when he's asked about it publicly, even amongst the Mormons, he's like, polygamy? No way. Have you only ever seen one other wife? Emma's my only wife. What are you talking about, polygamy? I don't know what you're talking about. So there's this four-year period where he's got 10 wives, 15 wives, 20 wives, 30 wives, 40 wives, where he's lying about it. And it's other men's wives. Simultaneously, he raises the largest militia in the state of Illinois. Joseph Smith had a larger militia in the 1840s than the state of Illinois. And everyone was getting scared. He was practicing polygamy and lying about it. And it came to a head where Joseph Smith's, one of his top leaders, his right-hand man, his name was William Law. Joseph had been lying to his own right-hand man about the polygamy. And then William Law leaves the church, starts a printing press called the Nauvoo Expositor, and publishes a single edition of his newspaper telling the whole world, Joseph Smith is a polygamist. He's got over 30 wives. Some of them are as young as 14. A lot of it is sex trafficking, where he's bringing these women from Europe as poor immigrants and then bringing them on as wives once they come parentless to America. It's a scandal. Everyone should know about it. And because Joseph Smith had been lying to everyone about it, and because it was so scandalous, when William Law printed this first edition of the Nauvoo Expositor, Joseph, who was not only prophet, not only mayor, not only head of the militia, he was chief justice, and he declared that the printing press should be destroyed. And so he violates the freedom of press and the separation of church and state. This destruction of the printing press, combined with the scandal of it being public knowledge that he had over 40 wives, lends him to prison, where he goes to a jail as a negotiated settlement because the mobs were ready to burn, literally burn Nauvoo down and lynch Joseph Smith. I don't mean to use an offensive term, but back in the 1800s, it's mob justice, right? They were ready to hang him or shoot him. So he is willing to submit himself to prison in negotiations with the governor of Illinois. He's in prison with two or three other Mormons up in the top of the prison in Carthage, Illinois. And while he's being held there, a mob assembles together, storms the prison, goes up the stairs and kills Joseph and his brother in a mob, you know, murder, frankly. And it's really hard for those of us that were raised to love Joseph Smith. We were taught that he went like a lamb to the slaughter, that he was innocent of all charges. And that was a lie. He was totally guilty. He didn't deserve being killed, but he definitely deserved being in prison. And he definitely did horrific things to other people's wives and daughters and financially. But did he deserve to be killed in cold blood? Probably not. But he deserved to be in prison probably for the rest of his life. So we're sad that we're angry that we were lied to. We're sad that he was killed. But those of us who are honest kind of feel like he deserved it.
And, you know, it's really interesting that you're saying that, because like the foundation of the Mormon church is way worse than Jehovah's Witnesses.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, with all that, you know, polygamy and stuff going on.
And murders. Like there's something called the Mountain Meadows Massacre where Mormons in southern Utah massacred like over 100 men, women, and children. They dressed up as Native Americans so the Native Americans would be blamed.
Yeah.
And then they massacred over 100 men, women, and children, stole their property. We have some really dark wow. things in our history.
That's so amazing.
I can give you guys hope. Maybe you guys can become even better than you are now. Maybe your wow. leaders take inspiration from our leaders.
Oh, my goodness.
Things can get better.
Oh my goodness! Yeah, when you let people loose with thinking that God whispers in their ear, man, it can make some problems. I mean, it can make some problems.
Yeah,
Well, yeah, I'm so glad that you woke up too. Like,
yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's go ahead. I'm sorry, ladies.
I was gonna say, how long have you been doing your activism, John?
So 16 years. I started in 2005. So okay. I've had a podcast for 16 years.
Wow.
Excellent.
Wow.
Excellent.
And over that period of time, I'm sure you have helped so many people from your perspective. I can't imagine the same. Because the people who leave your group and leave our group that we were a part of, they interestingly struggle with the same basic issues. And that is trying to find their identity again, because our identity has always been tied up so tight in our religious belief system. And when that unravels, you literally feel like you're naked. I mean, you know, it's like, what do I do now? Where do I go? And so it's a challenge. It's a
challenge. So, John, do you have any final parting words that you would like to share?
Yes. I love JT and Lady C. I love what you guys are doing. I want you to, you know, number one, I'm later to the YouTube game. You guys have way more YouTube experience than me, and your programming is top notch in its quality. So I just want to say I have mad respect to you two and what you're doing. I also love Lloyd Evans. I am so inspired by the ex-Jehovah's Witnesses that I'm aware of. And I just want to give you guys a shout out, because there's so many Mormons. Like, how did I find out about you guys? My good friend, Jason Moore, whose birthday is today. Happy birthday, Jason. He won't hear this until later, but I'm going to give him a shout out anyway. Mormons, ex-Mormons are inspired by what you guys are doing in the ex-Jehovah's Witness movement. So the first thing I want to say is I respect you and admire you for your courage and your quality of your work. Secondly, thank you to all of you to help our people come out of a high-demand religion. That's the first thing I wanted to say. The second thing I wanted to say is to all your listeners, thank you so much for supporting you guys. I want to ask your listeners to do whatever they can to support you. I remember trying to ask you about donations or whatever. All I can say is, listeners, it is extremely hard. Viewers and listeners, it is extremely hard to do what JT and Lady C do. They have jobs. Unlike me, they have full-time jobs where they have to earn a living. So please support them. Support them with sharing links. Support them with likes. Subscribe to their channel. And if you can, find ways to donate financially to support them. Even though they would never want to take advantage of you financially, you want them financially supported. If I could wave a magic wand today, JT and Lady C would make six figures. And let me just tell you why. Because Jehovah's Witnesses need you guys. And this is really hard work to stand as a public voice against a super wealthy, high demand religion where their armies of lawyers and money and their minions would love nothing more than to destroy those efforts. And so if I could wave a magic wand, your donors would stand up, donate enough to where you guys could do this as a full-time job, and you guys could be able to sustainably do this, because there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Jehovah's Witnesses that need exactly what you are doing. So if I wanted to say another thing, it would be support JT and Lady C in this amazing program. That's the second thing I want to say. The third thing I want to say is, can we please keep collaborating? Can you guys come back on my show? Can we figure out ways to creatively work together? Can we even have an annual conference every year where we get together, all of our followers and listeners come together, we learn from each other, just like the Mormon Church is doing with Scientologists and Jehovah's Witnesses? Can ex-Scientologists, ex-Jehovah's Witnesses, ex-Mormons have a national conference every year where we teach each other podcasting, teach each other YouTubes, share best practices, and teach each other how we can help rescue more and more and more people from the harm of high demand religions and or cults? How's that for three things?
Awesome.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
I love it. Thank you so much. We appreciate those fine words that you have to say.
I think that at the end of the day, all of us, and we encourage people all the time, let your voice be heard. if you went through any of these types of religious groups and your life has been impacted, you need to set up a way to let people hear you express it. I know as a Jehovah's Witness, the organization wants you to be silent. They want you to shut up and go somewhere, sit down and be quiet. But that's not happening. That is not happening. And if you watch the YouTube environment, we're seeing more and more people. They're reaching the point where they say, you know what? I got to add my voice. And we want people, add your voice. Add your voice. Let people know that what we're saying, because people all around the world need to know, because people all around the world have been impacted by this religion. And not just Jehovah's Witnesses, these other high control groups, they literally take our families away from us. And the goal is for us to feel as though we are alone. You're not. As John has shown in his channel and other channels, you're not by yourself. You are not by yourself. The key is we have to work together. And really, at the end of the day, you know, it's not about us as individuals. You know, this stuff can get heady. People, oh, he's great. Well, really, you know, we're just all trying our best to put our best foot forward. I tell people all the time, and my wife, we often discuss this. You know, we left 20 years ago. Some people told us, y'all guys need to go and tell y'all story and reach back. JT, you and Lady T need to reach back. Y'all guys rolling up ahead, reach back. And so we didn't think it would be any big deal, but we have been absolutely surprised at the number of people who have said to us in all kinds of media, thanks, I appreciate it. You got me started. I can make it on my own now. And that's really what we want to do. We want people not to become dependent on us or anyone else. We want people to learn to stand on your own feet. That's what got us in trouble. We kept depending on somebody else. And so we tell people, learn to think critically. This way you can stand on your own 2 feet. And as Jesus said to the man, pick up your cot, man, and walk, roll. And that's what we tell people. Pick up your cot and roll. And you can. And there are people all around the world right now who they are making the decision with this COVID, with this Zoom going on at the Kingdom Hall. They're like, you know what? I don't know if I can do this no more. And they're looking again. They're taking a second look. And that's what you want to do. And you will find there are, I can't stress this enough, people. There is life after Watchtower. It really is. They make us believe that you can't make it without them. It's like a man beat up his wife and tell her, you know, you ain't no good without me and you can't make it. You was dirt. You were in the gutter for I found. That's the way the organization literally treats us as adults. Well, you know what? We can walk and you can do it. And so, you know, Lady C, you know, and John, I both, you know, I can't say enough. I thank my wife for everything she does. And John, you know, we talked before, even though we came through different high control groups, it's amazing how much our stories are almost identical.
And that's why I want to piggyback.
Can I get an amen?
Amen. I want to say amen too. And I want to say there's not just life after Watchtower, but there's life after the Mormon Church, Scientology, you know, Seventh-day Adventist, all of those places.
Amen.
Right?
Yeah, it really amen. Is. Amen.
Well, I tell you, John, thank you so much. John, send us your contact stuff, your links and everything. We'll put it into the video. And
the main link is MormonStories.org. If people want to check out my podcast, there's a YouTube channel. Just it's Mormon Stories. Or if you want to go to MormonStories.org. But I'll send you some links. But mostly, I have a dream. I'm going to tell you a dream I have. I have a dream to meet you guys in person someday.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, absolutely. Yes.
I want to come to D.C. or have you come to Utah. Or have us meet at some other location.
Absolutely.
I want not just to meet you guys, but I want us to see what good we can do through collaboration.
Yeah. And that's the key. That's the key. That's just really key. Work it. If, as I said, the more hands, the easier it is to do.
Anytime you guys want me back, if you're just like, oh, who are we going to have this week?
Yeah, we'll have to do that.
Back anytime you ask. Yeah. So we have, I'll just tell you quickly, we do have another podcast called The Gift. This is going to sound weird. The Gift of the Mormon Faith Crisis. And you can find that at MormonFaithCrisis.com. And what we did is I, along with a marriage and family therapist, sex therapist, and then my wife, Margie, we put up 70 hours of content for people leaving Mormonism. And it's basically a mental health perspective on how to leave a high demand religion. So you can go to MormonFaithCrisis.com and just start watching the videos and learning. And that really is a manual on how to go through the process of leaving, grieving, you know, communicating with family and friends, navigating your marriage, getting an identity, creating new family rituals, how to parent. Like, we do cover that in MormonFaithCrisis.com. So listeners, you guys are welcome to check that out. Listeners are welcome to. And if you ever want me to just like prepare parenting or prepare grieving or prepare mental health after a faith crisis, I would literally like come on your show and just like share with you some of the things that we've shared elsewhere. Because we hold retreats and workshops, you know, as someone with a psychology PhD, you know, we hold workshops and retreats because it really does require experts to help people through this from a mental health perspective. And I just want to say, with no charge, free, I am always willing to be a resource for your community if you ever want
me. Thank you so much.
Yeah, we appreciate that.
Appreciate that.
And we have a lot to learn from you guys, and I'm not saying that.
As I tell you, we all can learn from each other.
We'll have you guys. We'd love to have you guys back on Mormon Stories.
Okay, hey, man, perfect.
John, thank you so much. Tell the family. We didn't mean to hold you up so long tonight, but we appreciate their patience. And at this point, we want to just sign off to all of our listeners on the podcast and all those who will be watching on the video. We want to just say thank you once again. And this has been JT.
And this has been Lady C.
Y'all take care.
Thank you for tuning in.
Keep it up, guys.
All right.
This program was sponsored by Critical Thinkers.